Committee, my sorry for my tardiness, our Ways and Means Committee is running, I think it's still running late. So, did they finish up?
Just finished.
Okay. Here's the plan for this evening, and I know folks have commitments, so we're going to try and get everybody out of here by 6 o'clock, 6:30. I understand that one of the freshman rebels is here. We're going to hear his bill, House Bill 2910, first, then move to the good Senator Morissette, because he has a panel, I think. And then we'll hear concerns of opposition to 1050. Then we'll go back up to 2082, and by then I'm confident that the parties on 891 will have an agreement worked out so that we can move that bill. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2910. Ms. Taylor, why don't you tell us what we have? Representative Cannon, come on forward. And Senator Farrioli, you get the gavel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2910, as drafted, requires political committees to designate a person in addition to a treasurer to receive notices from the filing officer. However, you have the Dash 3 amendment in front of you, which replaces the measure, and the Dash A3 amendment allows an otherwise qualified person who is at least 17 years old to register to vote, and that person can vote in an election as long as they're 18 years old.
Please proceed, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Ben Cannon, State Representative, District 46 in Portland, and I bring to you a very rebellious proposal, since it is a gut and stuff amendment of a bill. And I just want to point out for the record, I have not prepared at all to speak to the original bill. I'm here really to speak only to the Dash 3 amendments. I understand from the sponsor of House Bill 2910 that he is perfectly okay with replacing the bill with these Dash 3 amendments. As the committee administrator described, these amendments would allow a 17-year-old to register to vote. Not to vote, you have to be 18 to vote, but if we pass 2910 as amended here, you would be able to register to vote when you're 17 years old. Current law is that a 17-year-old can register to vote within 60 days of an election upon which they're going to be 18. So this would be expanding that window, giving many more 17-year-olds opportunity to register to vote. The reasons for this, I think this is a really excellent opportunity to raise our voter registration for young voters in particular. Whereas 69% of 25 to 44-year-olds are registered to vote and 83% of 45 to 64-year-olds are registered to vote, only 56% of 18 to 24-year-olds are registered to vote. There are a whole lot of reasons for that. This amendment in and of itself is not going to address all of them. However, it is going to give folks in high school teachers, high school administrators, folks working with high schoolers, the opportunity to take advantage of this usually captive audience of high school seniors, many of whom are 17 years old, and get them registered to vote. I could go on and on. I'm a teacher. I see the value of this partly in the context of our education setting, the way this could connect with civics education, particularly for juniors and seniors. You know, the period after high school is often a disruptive period of time in people's lives, so there's a great, I think, window of opportunity here for 17-year-olds that we ought to take advantage of. I want to encourage you to take a good look at this. I understand there may be concerns. I'm happy to respond to questions. I think it's a proposal that's strongly worth your consideration, and I'd urge your support.
Thank you, Representative Cannon. Questions?
Good bill.
All right. I guess you're off the hook. Yes, lucky
that
for
was
you.
The rebel yells.
Okay. I hope you informed the Oregonian that their title was wrong, their headline, their grammar and their headline was wrong. So I'm assuming that with all of your education, someone picked up on that. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2910 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1050. Ms. Taylor, why don't you tell us a little bit about that? And Senator Morissette, Senator Whitsitt, if you want to bring your certified smart people forward with you as well. Great.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 1050 requires the Department of Energy to confer with governing boards of local governments within whose jurisdiction certain facilities should be located. This bill does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Senator Morissette, Senator Whitsett.
Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6, thank you very much for hearing this bill. I believe all of you sitting at the dais voted for a bill that was even more demanding than this last session. It did pass the Senate unanimously. This is an energy siting bill. The bill that we have before you today is a modification. It's a kinder, gentler approach, but it is just as important that those individuals who are involved in the hearings of whether or not a power plant should be sited in a particular area and have some concerns, have their concerns addressed, and that's what this bill does. I do have some testimony that I believe you'd have, and I will stop there. Senator Whitsett has some remarks, and Michael Graney, who is the director of the Energy Department, would like to leave early, but we have him sitting between us, and both of us have our elbows out, so he can't leave until he's given testimony.
Senator Whitsett, take it away.
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. I'm Senator Doug Whitsett, representing Senate District 28. You have my written testimony to expedite the process here. You know, there is a compelling need for more local input into the siting, energy facility siting process. I know that because I personally experienced the current process and learned firsthand how inadequate that process represents the interest of local communities and stakeholders. For that reason, we brought forth the bill last session. It passed the, as Senator Morissette pointed out, passed the Senate 29 zip. And this is a kinder, gentler bill. Created entirely, the language of this bill is created entirely by the Department of Energy with the, as I understand, the input of the Department of Justice and the Governor's staff. It was submitted to Legislative Council without any changes in their proposition. Essentially, what the bill does is it does not change or lessen the state's siting authority. It's meant to avoid the useless adversarial situation that costs all participants so much time, energy, and angst and money. Rather than, it simply requires FSEC to explain its legal authority and rational reasoning to the citizens at each step of the procedure. Some concerns have been expressed that this bill creates another layer of bureaucracy. I would draw your attention to, in the written testimony, to ORS 469.480, Senate Bill 1050 does not change current statute on that basis. Some concerns have been expressed that this bill may have a fiscal impact. I really doubt that, in that it is my understanding that this cost of the siting process are charged to and paid by the applicant. Any costs incurred by the local government entities that may be reimbursed by the department would also be paid by the applicant. So I really don't see where this would change the cost to the state government at all. And as oxymoronic as that may seem, it appears that the similar bill last session was opposed by some environmental groups. Fossil fuel power generation facilities produce immense quantities of carbon dioxide. These emissions must be mitigated by cash payments to the extent that they exceed the EPA clean air limits. Last session, one of the governor's staff, patiently explained to me why this is. Much of that mitigation cash is actually channeled through the Oregon Climate Trust. Many of the grants made by the Climate Trust are made to environmental organizations. A power generation plant not built represents a potential loss of revenue for the environmental groups. I think this is a good bill. I think it really will help in the process. It will help people understand, get their voices heard, get the Department of Energy to respond to those concerns. Won't change the siting authority, but I think it will really smooth up the process and give the people a better voice and certainly the perception of more due process. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. You've been joined by a colleague from the House. Would you like to have him come up?
Madam Chair, I need to respond to something.
That's fine, Senator Morsak. Go ahead.
My colleague said. It was interesting last session. Both of us, Senator Whitsitt and myself, had a bill. Don't go away.
Keep going, Senator Morsak. We will not let him
okay.
leave.
We both had a bill. My bill was at the request of the environmental community. And you have a letter from Lisa Arkin explaining why we introduced this bill. It was a gas-fired plant in Coburg. The people were outraged, very upset. There was a water rights issue. There was a lot to it. So that was sponsored by the environmental community. Since then, Senator Whitsitt and his wife have literally adopted Lisa as their own, which... We've worked, so the environmental community is working together with us on this. It's not that they're concerned about losing money if this passes at all. The other thing I must say is I attended the Supreme Court hearing as a result of a suit that Senator Whitsitt filed. It cost $200,000 in 2 years to appeal the case from the siting council to the state Supreme Court. The Supreme Court found that they followed the law. The law said they can do anything they want, and they did. They followed the law to the letter. They did anything they wanted. They questioned whether or not they followed their own rules, though, but that didn't have any effect on the decision. So what we're saying is people need at least the satisfaction of having a reasonable explanation by the agency if they choose to do anything they want in disregard what citizens are asking them to do. So with that, I will end, and my good friend from Klamath Falls will pick up the gauntlet and carry it.
Thank you.
Representative Garrard, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bill Garrard, State Representative, District 56, which is Southern Klamath County. I will be brief. Senate Bill 1050 that my colleague Senator Whitsitt brings to you today would help prevent another Oregon community from going through what my community went through for over 3 years, and that was division and controversy. Senate Bill 1050 helps the process of siting, in this case it was a natural gas-fired power plant, in a community. Not through changing existing laws, but by simply educating the people, step by step. I commend Senator Whitsitt and Senator Morsak for their hard work on this bill and the issue solutions that it proposes. This is a good bill that will help the people understand the siting process and result in less adversarial confrontations. Senator Whitsitt is far more eloquent in describing the details of this event that happened in our community, but I support Senate Bill 1050. Chair Brown, members of the committee, I ask for your support in moving this bill forward, and thank you for the courtesy of the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you. Mr. Graney, why don't you come on forward, and then we'll take questions. I don't know, Representative Garrard, if you can stay. Okay, you're welcome to stay.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Mike Graney from the Department of Energy. I have worked with Senator Morsak and Senator Whitsitt on this bill as an alternative to one they drafted earlier this session and last session that we had concerns about. And I think this bill is useful in clarifying the role of local governments in the energy siting process. Let me just make a couple of remarks, and I've left you a written statement with more details on the siting process and on the specific changes that Senate Bill 1050 does. But our siting process is a centralized siting process where the Energy Facility Siting Council makes the decision with input from the other state agencies and local agencies that would normally issue permits. It's a balancing act. We're charged on the one hand to make decisions efficiently within time frames specified in statute, because of the need for energy resources. On the other hand, to also have a process that citizens can easily participate in a meaningful way, and to assure environmental protection. Just a few years ago, in 2001, we were facing an energy shortage, and the legislature then made a number of changes to our siting process to expedite decision-making while still preserving these other values. And I think the record is good that, in fact, you made good decisions then. Since 2001, six plants with over 1,500 megawatts have come online and are operating. Our siting council approved another five plants with over 2,000 megawatts more, half of which are wind energy and half of which are natural gas. There was no opposition to any of those. Five other plants are pending with 2,000 megawatts, 1,500 of which are renewable energy, and only one of which has opposition. The three plants that both senators mentioned, and they were controversial, Turner, Coburg, and Klamath County, all were terminated through the existing siting process. So I think the siting process works, perhaps not as quickly and as easily as they would have liked, but we did reach resolution in those proceedings. And, in fact, in two of those three cases, there was active opposition by the local governments themselves, and that clearly affected the siting council's decision and the department's decision, as I've elaborated in the written testimony. Senate Bill 1050 does specify the role that local governments can take at each stage of the review that's undertaken either by the Department of Energy in a role as technical staff for the council or when the council itself makes decisions. And I think that clarification is helpful. At the same time, I think this will not unduly complicate the siting process and will not keep us from making the decisions that need to be made in a timely manner. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions or elaborate further.
Thank you, Mr. Graney. Thanks for. I know you work very closely with Senator Whitsitt and Senator Morissette, and we appreciate your work. Senator Johnson.
A comment and a question. First of all, I wish this bill applied to FSEC. Maybe you can work on that the next time around the federal process.
Oh, I'm sure. Senator Johnson, you mean Federal Energy Regulatory Commission? Oh,
yes.
I do, too. I wish you had jurisdiction over them.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't use the acronym. But one of the issues that's been raised about the bill is whether or not it creates a parallel universe with the Energy Facility Siting Council here in Oregon, and it is duplicative or a usurpation. To me, it feels like just more opportunity for citizen input. I'd like your reaction, if you wouldn't mind.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Johnson. This does not set up a parallel or new process. It simply clarifies within the existing process the opportunities local governments have to participate and the obligation in turn on either the department or the siting council, depending on which stage we're at, to respond as to whether those recommendations are accepted, and if not, why not.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate you joining us. Next up, Scott Bolton, Gary Bauer, Brendan McCarthy.
Good afternoon, Chair Brown, members of the committee. I'm Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. And as I think all of you know, we are a natural gas utility that serves customers, roughly 600,000 customers in Oregon and some in southern Washington, mm-hmm. Clark County area. Our responsibility really is to provide natural gas for home heating, commercial services. We do not build any of these facilities that the sponsors have talked about, nor do we generally sell gas to them. So I kind of want to make sure you understand where I'm coming from. We do, however, have to go through the siting process to build pipelines if they're greater than a certain size and a certain length. And so we do have some interest and some concern in the process. We're generally in front of the commission on a regular basis. Any changes to the site certificates that we have to go back through the process and involve the siting council. What I passed out is a flow chart that's actually put together by the siting council that shows the process that we would end up going through building a pipeline. And to share with you, our last major application was started off to be 50-some miles. It ended up being over 60 miles of a natural gas pipeline. And we started that process in 1999. And it took us 18 months to go through the first phase, which is just a notice of intent to tell the state that we were going to go and we had an interest in building this. In that process, you involve a lot of the community. We held public meetings. Notices go out to local governments. And so there's definitely a long process there. And you take into account the issues that are raised by folks. We then submitted an application in 2001. We chose to hold public meetings and went out and talked to folks in the community. And again, it was distributed to agencies and local governments for their input. That took about 6 months. Then you actually file an application with the Siting Council. And we did that again. That's distributed to local governments for input and comment. We held public meetings again around the area, because what we really needed to do was find out what folks' concerns were about this. And we know that when you build what's called a linear facility and you're going to touch property owners for 50 to 60 miles, that there are definitely issues. And that's why we ended up adding about 10 miles to the route in order to accommodate environmental issues, concerns raised by local governments and citizens. So we try to take into account a lot of those issues. You can't accommodate everybody in the end. Generally, we had folks not oppose the project because it was a pipeline. We generally had people saying, why don't you build it closer to the city, or why don't you put it a little further out in the rural area? And in some cases, why don't you just put it across the street so it's not on my side of the street? So those are, you're going to end up with those types of issues. You're going to end up with some concerns. Just to kind of lead through this, it basically took us over 4 years from the very beginning of this process until we actually received and went through the court proceeding. In that time frame, our energy needs and our need for the pipeline actually increased to the point that once we got the site certificate, we chose to build 12 miles prior to getting an answer from the Supreme Court. We got an answer from the Supreme Court, which basically said, yes, the pipeline met all of the criteria. If we had not built those 12 miles, we actually would have had people out of service during the winter. By the time we got done, our energy needs were that close. And so that's one of the reasons we have just a general concern about adding additional steps to the process. I totally understand what folks are concerned about. We thought we went very much an extra step to involve the public. Again, we couldn't accommodate everybody's concerns, but we worked real hard at trying to do that. So again, we have a real concern about extending a process, bringing a process in that actually now requires the Siting Council to basically answer to the point that everybody along this route, and again, we had multiple jurisdictions that we would have to address, and our goal is to try to get a pipeline connected from one end to the other. And if we have local governments saying, that's fine, just tell us why you don't put it over here, and someone says, put it over here, we have to line up at some point in order to complete the pipe. So with that, I'll stop and let my colleagues comment. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Brown, members of the committee. I'm Brendan McCarthy. I'm here representing Portland General Electric. We are a electric power company, as you probably know, serving over 800,000 customers, representing about 1.5 million people in a territory spanning about 4,100 square miles in the northern Willamette Valley and Portland metro area. Be fairly brief today. Generally speaking, I think we believe that Senate Bill 1050 is a solution in search of a problem. I think you heard from the proponents of this bill that notwithstanding the problems that they had, the existing siting process worked. It's PGE's experience that ODO and FSEC carefully consider the comments made in the very public process and recommend any conditions that to be placed in the site certificate necessary to reflect those concerns. It's rare, and indeed, when I was talking with our experts inside the company, no one could actually think of a time that FSEC failed to incorporate into the site certificate a recommendation from a special advisory group. We believe that Senate Bill 1050 gives local governments and, by extension, the special advisory groups more discretion than those local governments would have in reviewing any other development application. They can basically tell FSEC that they should deny the site certificate and do so without any standards, without any reference to a standard. When FSEC goes to then defend its decision, if they decide to approve the application, they have no basis to understand the decision that the local government, how the local government made their decision. So it puts FSEC in a very difficult position and shifts the burden to them to show that the decision is proper. Even if FSEC complies with all of the standards that they've already laid out, there's one more hurdle, and it's unclear exactly how they're going to show that the decision is proper. The local government can merely say, we would prefer that you deny a certificate. The last piece is FSEC is right now concluding a 10-month process of rulemaking. There is a very public process for rulemaking. The public has an opportunity to get involved in that rulemaking and get FSEC to change their standards. If the standards are insufficient, there are 13 applicable standards that they've already developed. If the standards are insufficient to protect health and safety of the public, they can change those in the rulemaking process.
Thank you. Mr. Bolton.
Thank you, Chair Brown. Members of the committee, my name is Scott Bolton. I'm with Pacific Power. We serve about 550,000 customers here in Oregon. We also operate in six states, serving about 1.7 million customers across the West. I'll echo the concerns of my fellow utility brothers at the table here, and really try and keep this high level. Our business plans to make significant investment in new generation and transmission resources over the next 10 years, bringing significant new jobs, energy infrastructure, and increasing the property tax rolls of Oregon. I don't think it's any secret that our grid is starting to age, that there is a real need for particularly new major transmission investment. And oftentimes this transmission is interstate in nature. We're bringing power from states in the Rocky Mountains over to Oregon and Washington. We're moving hydropower from Washington down into Oregon and into Northern California. There's a lot of different directions we've got to take energy and a lot of new infrastructure needed to move it. And really, Senate Bill 1050, again, echoing the concerns of my colleagues, seems to create new uncertainties and more possibilities for delay in deploying capital and adding infrastructure to the state. We're certainly sympathetic and absolutely concerned about the input of the local communities that are impacted by our investment. And similar to my comments from PGE, we take great diligence in trying to incorporate those concerns into the eventual site certificates and projects that we do end up deploying for our customers. And I think what you see really are three businesses that are rooted in the community and have a vested interest in making sure that new generation facilities and transmission facilities and any facility that's brought in under FSEC meets, if it can't satisfy all the parties, at least meets the criteria set by the siting process. Again, the examples that have been brought up of merchant power plants that have been on the drawing boards but never fully realized because of local opposition, I think is an indication that, you know, the process not only works, but, you know, businesses are going to get the signal if they're not wanted in a community. They don't stay around. And so we intend to make sure that where we do invest, those are investments that are welcomed in the community, and the current FSEC process does bring parties together to figure out that critical question. So, again, I know you've got a lot on your agenda. I'll wrap up there and take any questions.
Questions for this panel? Is it fair to say that your concerns, the three of yours, increased time and costs, makes projects more uncertain, and current law provides ample opportunity for public participation?
It's a good way to sum it up.
All right. Senator Morissette, Senator Whitsitt, why don't you come up and respond to those concerns briefly? And
just one.
Senator Moss-Anderson.
In what Mr. Bauer gave us on the Oregon Energy Facility Siting Council, the actual process, you have in here two public information meetings, one right before the project order, or before you submit the application, and the other is on the draft proposed order. And I know the first one is optional. Are those used, and do you have a lot of public input? If any of you have gone through the process, can you tell me?
Chair Senator Moniz-Anderson, yes. On our pipeline, we also added, we used those public meetings. We added additional meetings. We did multiple meetings. We didn't do just one. We did multiple meetings, and we moved them into various local communities because our pipeline was, like I say, ended up being 60-plus miles. So we actually held multiple local meetings. The Siting Council also held some of their monthly meetings, which aren't shown on this, in along the route so that people could make comments. One question, of course, is safety, so we actually they devoted an entire meeting to safety. We also held meetings in the there's a phase where it talks about submitting the application. We held public meetings there as well. There's public hearings on the draft order, and then there's an actual formal hearing process once they actually are prepared to issue an order. So there's a contested case. So again, we during the 4-plus years, we had multiple meetings, and we held some of those ourselves, and most of them were in conjunction with the state.
And just one follow-up. I just want to know, was there active local participation usually at these public hearings?
Chair Munson, Anderson, definitely.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Chair Johnson.
I guess I want to just follow up on that a little bit, having attended a number of FSEC hearings. Sometimes they're a little intimidating. They're awfully formal, and I'm all for increasing citizen participation, particularly in these sometimes very contentious siting processes. Having just come out of the crucible of having the federal government doing siting in my district, they have done such a poor job, including having public meetings where the public wasn't allowed to speak. It tends to temper my approach to this kind of legislation to force a level of participation. I know I'm mixing apples and oranges, talking about a state process and a federal process, but I just would like your comments on whether or not you think that the FSEC meetings are adequately noticed, they're held at times working people can come, whether the three of you, and I'd invite any one of you to answer, whether you think that we adequately provide a forum for the public to come in and speak in an environment that is not intimidating to just regular working folks.
Chair Brown, Senator Johnson, I'll respond again on our project. Yes, they were held in the evenings. I'd say the one that probably is intimidating is when you do get to a contested case proceeding, only because it is a more formal process, but one which is necessary if you want to set a formal record in case somebody wants to appeal. But all of the other meetings were held in the evenings. I can't say all. I do remember one that was held during the day, but generally we held them all in the evenings. Again, we moved them around. Pretty, very informal process, basically. Allowing anybody that wanted to speak was allowed to speak. Very different from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's process that you were just put yourself through.
Chair Brown, Senator Johnson, I guess just to maybe put a little bit of a capstone on that. As we envision particularly a transmission siting process, which is similar to a gas pipeline where you have a long linear project, you're going to touch a lot of communities and a lot of different jurisdictions along the way. For us, the FSEC process is really the minimum. It's really where you start. Oftentimes, and what we anticipate doing is having a pretty substantial scoping project as well, where we're meeting with communities, leaders from those communities beforehand, even as before we enter into the FSEC process. And certainly the amount of public involvement required under FSEC, again, is not, it's really the starting point. There can be more if you have a more controversial or you have a more involved project.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
Senator, may I apologize?
Quick.
Just one additional comment. I think Senator Johnson asked whether or not she thought people got adequate notice. In addition to formal legal notices, both FSEC as well as the company maintain a mailing list of every property owner within kind of a path, basically, of the routes. And we made sure that they were mailed every time related to any of the hearings, and also did just periodic updates so that they didn't feel that whatever they were concerned about was just went into a dark hole.
Thank you. Thank you. Sarah Morissette, Senator Whitsitt, you want to come up and...
We have a mystery guest. With your permission, we'd like to invite Ed.
Hopefully he will be brief.
Yes. Ed is never brief, but he's usually on point.
He had a half an hour before the Supreme Court. I want to just say something about why the power plant in Eugene did not succeed in Coburg. They couldn't get the water right. They tried for 3 years. It had nothing to do with denial from the agency.
Okay.
A lot of these delays are due to other things, and pretty soon they just decide to go somewhere else. So,
okay.
I haven't read the bill. I'm Ed Sullivan.
Okay.
the best kind of non-prejudicial.
Senator Johnson asked about the notice and the process. There's lots of notice given. It's given by letter, but in order to participate, you've got to be a party in order to be able to take the matter up. And you have to ask for party status, and there's a formal process for that. That's somewhat intimidating. It's not like your usual planning commission or board of county commissioners. So that's one thing. It is intimidating to be in the contested case process. Everybody's under oath. You all know that. And it's hard for ordinary people off the streets to get their concerns out. What I understand from Senator Whitsitt, having FSEC respond to the concerns in writing, it's not too onerous a burden, and it seems like a good idea.
Did you introduce yourself properly? Did you give your background, your qualifications to testify on this issue?
Take judicial notice.
The chair is going to take judicial notice, even though she's not currently a judge and, frankly, at this point does not want to be one. So, thank you. And I guess, Mr. Sullivan, and I guess Senator Whitsitt, Senator Morissette, the issue for me is where we are in terms of providing energy to our customers, our constituents, and making sure that we can do that in a very timely and most cost-effective fashion right now, and the concern about how public process and adequate notice versus being able to do that, given where we are with what I would call an energy crisis. Could either one of you respond to that?
Chair Brown, yes. Mr. Sullivan actually was of counsel to the group that was and carried that case to the and argued it before the Supreme Court, so he is pretty familiar with the case. I think the best way to answer your question is what happened, and just a brief discussion of what happened in Klamath. It was an effort to site an 1,140-megawatt gas-fired power plant in an EFU zone, which is actually a seed potato field about 2 miles from Bonanza, Oregon. The plant was actually sited, and it was contested and then carried an appeal to the Supreme Court, and the siting was upheld. Not only was it in an EFU zone, it was in an enterprise zone that had been extended some 25 miles in a linear fashion from the urban growth boundary in Klamath Falls to create that enterprise zone, that opportunity. It was built, or would have been built, directly on a normal fault with 2,200 feet of vertical displacement. One of the documents that brought that was brought to support the siting of the plant was brought by CH2M Hill. That particular document was only introduced in part, and when we tried to introduce the other part, it wasn't timely introduced, so we didn't get to use it. But the other part of it said was that there was about it was directly on a fault, and there was about 200 feet of according to the boreholes, about 200 feet of slick and slide on this from this fault right under this or very near to this this site. It was a completely unstable site. It was sited anyway. The groundwater issue. Originally, there was going to be a water cool plant. It was a would have used 12,000 acre feet of groundwater annually and put it up in steam, the ultimate use, ultimate consumptive use. Water for Life actually brought a contest on that, and was able to resolve that issue to the point where they were you're going to make an air cool plant out of it. Again, this was the citizen input that did it. It wasn't the siting council that did it. The safety issue, City of Bonanza is about 3 miles away, and I don't mean to demean the Bonanza RFD at all, but they are farmers, and when the call comes in, something in their pocket buzzes whether they're in the on a swather or on a horse up in the juniper trees or driving a potato truck. So their response time is not exactly immediate, and also they have no equipment to deal with such a plant. So those were the things, some of the things that the citizens were concerned about and were unable to get resolved, because basically the response was, we have the authority to cite it under the statute, therefore we don't have to adequately address your concerns. There is all kinds of effort to come out and get people to give their opinions, to give their written testimony, but there appears to me to be a complete ignoring of the input from the citizens, and this is designed to require the Department of Energy and FSEC to respond, just to respond, to explain, and I don't think that's unreasonable. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you all joining us, particularly your star appearance, Mr. Sullivan. Thanks for stepping in. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1050. We're going to go back up to House Bill 2910 and bring in, holy smokes, John Lindback, Elon Hassan, Sasha, Senator Deckert. No. Okay, Senator Deckert, want to testify? Okay. Janice Thompson? And then we'll get Cappy on here in a minute, too. All right. Welcome. Thank you. I don't know if I opened a public hearing, but we're back on in 2910.
My name is Elon Hassan for the Secretary of State's office. I'll keep it really brief. The Secretary of State's office has worked with Senator Deckert on this, and we like the concept of the bill. It would just allow, as Representative Cannon stated, to register students at the age of 17 or anybody at the age of 17. At this point in time, people know when they turn 17. It'd be an obvious date for them to enter the system, as opposed to now, where it's 6 days before the election, which they may or may not know. And for any technical issues, I'll turn it over to the Director of Elections.
I'm John Lindback, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. I do think that the current state of the law is confusing to young voters, because it says that they can vote, or they can register on the 60th day before the election in which they would be qualified to vote at the age of 18. And that causes some confusion out there among young people, and that by just saying that if you're 17 you can register and you're eligible to vote at age 18, but that's more understandable to people and draws a sort of a brighter line. We did have some discussions with county clerks about this today, and there were no policy objections from the clerks to doing this.
Okay.
I thought you ought to know that.
Thanks, John. That kind of raises two issues. I want to make sure that I'm not too worried about, you know, a flood of 17-year-olds starting to register, but I want to make sure that there is some level of security check so that we don't have 17-year-olds voting before they're actually 18, and kind of what that process would be. And the other question I had is to follow up with the clerks to make sure that they have no concerns and they have a way to filter these. Could you respond to that, please? And just to clarify for the record, this is an additional amendment. It's not a gut and stuff on the bill. So.
Well, currently we're dealing with those issues, Senator Brown, because it allows people who are under 18 to register to vote. So the clerks are already dealing with the issue about whether or not that person is qualified and making sure that they don't get a ballot until they truly turn 18. So that doesn't change anything in terms of the county business processes.
Okay.
Our centralized voter registration system is equipped so that you can enter that voter into the system, and that they are not sent a ballot until they're eligible at age 18.
Okay. Ms. Thompson.
Janice Thompson, Group Democracy Reform Oregon. Again, the backdrop for all this needs to be recognized as the policy decision to allow pre-registration of 17-year-olds as already having been made. And it's just really addressing the mechanics of that process. And as Mr. Lindbeck said, kind of simplifying it both from a county elections perspective as well as from this perspective of the 17-year-olds. I mean, just right now, you know, with these 60-day windows, it means that the year's broken up with kind of this patchwork with the 60-day windows linked to these official election days, you know, in March, May, September, November, when people don't necessarily think in terms of there being the election. So this is just kind of a confusing situation. The policy decision, I say, has already been made. You know, pre-registration by 17-year-olds is in place now. As Mr. Lindbeck indicated, you know, the clerks are dealing with that in terms of, like, the logistics and the security. And this approach that's facilitated by the centralized voter database I think, simplifies it both for the 17-year-old as well as for the county clerks. For example, as my kind of getting up to speed about how this played out, I had a conversation with the deputy director of Multnomah County who said, you know, they store them and at a certain, you know, if they come in too early, they have to send them back to the 17-year-old. But at a certain point, then they kind of store them, and then they'll process them. And I think this would just mean when they come in, they can process them. Okay. So just urge your support of the -3 amendments to the bill.
All right. Thank you. And I just want to clarify for the record that the amendments do gut and stuff the bill. The policy bill that we all like and love is in another vehicle. So. Sorry, it depends everything. Okay. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I am confused just for a minute. The policy bill that Ms. Thompson was referring to.
The policy that she's referring to is the allowing 17-year-olds to register to vote.
And what's the status of that bill?
No, that's current law.
Oh,
okay.
The gut and stuff is the contents of this particular bill.
Thank you.
And that is in another bill, which I believe is Senate Bill 78. Okay, good. All right, Kathy, come on up.
247. Good evening, members of the committee. Am I on? I guess so. Good evening, Senator Brown, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. You know who we are. Obviously, we're interested in bills that provide access to voters. I'm bringing the perspective of many of our local leagues who do go to high schools to register 18-year-olds or students who are going to be 18. And we have to turn a number of them down because they're not going to be able to vote at the next election because they will not. They're going to have to, they come in May and they want to vote in November. Well, the 60-day limit opts them out because they have to wait then till 60 days before the November election. We cannot accept their registrations. We are never sure whether they're, we give them a voter registration card, but we're never sure whether they're going to fill it out. This would enable us to allow the 17-year-olds who come to our table and would like to register to vote to do that. And then as we understand it, the county clerks would put those voting cards in a folder and a process where the computer would tell them when the kid's going to be 18, and a voter registration card or voter registration card, you know, telling them that they can vote would be issued. We think this is important. We also think this is going to better help civics classes and teachers to recognize the fact that these kids are getting ready to vote and perhaps do something about it. There are some high schools around the state and teachers in civics classes who do a very good job. There's one high school, and I'm sorry I can't tell you which it is, I just heard about it, where every month of the year in their junior class, senior class, when the kids, all the kids in that class who are going to turn 18, he hands out voter registration cards to them. But I think, as Representative Cannon pointed out, there are this would, we hope, facilitate some more interest in civics and kids who are younger and getting them into the idea of voting. Thank you.
And Cappy, your organization has no concerns about fraud or security issues or 17-year-olds gone wild voting in elections?
No, they. I think not. I have, Senator Brown, I have a granddaughter turning 17 next month, and I have a grandson turning 18 who is very anxious to vote. And so I have some perspectives from young people who would like to vote as soon as they can.
Thank you. Well, I'm sure they've had good training. Any questions for this witness?
Thank you
very much for joining us. Anybody else wishing to testify?
I don't think so. She doesn't want to testify.
Okay. All right. Anybody else? All right. Close the public hearing.
It's okay. I'm moving to work session. Okay.
Are you okay? I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2910. The chair would move the dash 3 amendments, which replace the measure and allow an otherwise qualified person who is at least 17 to register for vote, and prohibits a person from voting until the age 18 if they are registered at age 17, and requires DOT staff to inform 17-year-olds that they may register to vote. Chair would move the dash A3 amendments. Discussion? Senator Johnson.
Is there a fiscal with the notification?
If there is, it'll be going down to Ways and Means.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I did touch base with the Department of Transportation asking if they were going to have a problem with this, and they indicated that no, that they would have to do a minor update to their system, but it wouldn't be significant.
I guess the only comment, Madam Chair, I have not been hot on many of the ideas to try to force voter participation. Either people are engaged, motivated, participatory, or they're not. And it seems like this session we have just bent over backwards. Short of sitting on the end of somebody's bed helping them fill out the voter registration card, I just subscribe to the theory that you can take them to water, you can't make them drink. I think we're fooling ourselves if we think that this is going to suddenly cause a flourish of young, informed, activist voters. I wasn't going to support it. I will. If it helps, it helps. But I am not as starry-eyed optimistic about the flood of engaged civic participation that I think some people are with this bill.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. And I do recall, I don't know, I don't remember much from my high school days, and I don't know what you remember from your high school days, but I know that
we had... That would be the 60s, Madam Chair. We might have both had the same problem.
Senator Johnson, I don't think so. In any event, on multiple levels, I was in the 70s. My comment would be is that high schools had the resources to do a much more extensive job in terms of civics education, and I think our funding for civics education in the Department of Education budget is going to be under $200,000, and that's clearly not adequate, and so this is one little thing we can do. So, Senator Modis Anderson.
I have found, at least at the couple of high schools that I've visited in my district, that I feel that some of these students are much more engaged in the political process than I ever was, or my peers back in the 60s. I am very excited, since so many are 17 during their senior year and don't turn 18. I think it gives them the opportunity to get registered, and sometimes convenience really helps the situation. I think this will. Thank you.
Are there any objections to the amendment to the bill? Hearing and seeing none, except whining. So ordered. The chair would move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objections? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Senator Deckard should carry this bill. So, and I'm sure he'll make a great case on the Senate floor. All right. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2910, open a public hearing on 2082. Let's bring up Elon Hassan and John Lynn back. Are you the only two signed up to testify on 2082? Okay. Come on up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. You'll remember that House Bill 2082 is the big initiative reform bill. In your packet, you have four amendments to Dash A7, 9, 10, and 12.
I'm trying to bust some heads. Do you have a meeting, a dinner?
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Elon Hassan from the Secretary of State's office. There are a couple amendments in front of you, some of which are, all of which are good for the bill. But we want to talk about a couple of them now. I'm looking at the Dash 12s. These address the issue of the so-called writing requirement. And what this simply...
I didn't understand.
Sure.
Yes. Thank you. I didn't catch what you were saying.
There's, I wanted to talk about, Chair Farrelly, Senator Moss Anderson, there are several amendments before you. One of the more significant ones is the so-called writing requirement. And what the amendment does is simply require the citizen to write their name and address on the bill. Current practice is that a signature gatherer might have a citizen sign several different initiatives, and it raises several issues. The remaining information is often filled in by the paid signature gatherer. This causes two concerns for our office. First and foremost is they might get the names wrong, which has our people searching for names that don't exist and the person didn't sign it, and then those names aren't counting. Second of all, it just invites the paid signature gatherer to start writing on the page it fills out where the citizen should be signing. And, you know, we think that just invites fraud to the process. There's actually a video. Ellen Lowe from one of the supporters of Measure 26 wanted to be here today. And we have a video, if I could play it, that sort of demonstrates some of the issues at hand with people other than the citizen signing the petition.
I'm assuming this is not the American Idol version.
Is that a problem?
That it's short. Dancing
yes.
with the Stars.
The first thing you're going to see is a citizen who was asked to sign several different petitions, and that she did file a complaint with our office. This is the first part. This is just the signature gathering process. This is a story from K2 News.
I was at the Salem Center Mall. We were going to go see a movie, my friend Heather and I. And he was like, oh, where's this petition to sign? And I'm like, we're not registered voters. And he's like, well, that's okay. Just fill this out. And I'll make sure and turn them in because I want these signatures to count. And he's like, just sign them all because we need to send them to all the different representatives to make sure there's no... It was either sales tax or something to do with tax. Absolutely nothing about the death penalty was robbed. And that's... You know, what I found out that I signed later on, and I don't know the other things that I signed, but I don't want my name on those things. Okay, I put my name and the date and my address on the first form, and he's like, don't worry, we'll get the rest of it filled out. You don't have to worry about that. Just sign them all down. So they put Lisa Gilbert, and they put my zip code wrong, and the date was totally wrong. I signed in total belief that you know, they were just going to different representatives, but he told me that, and I signed all of them.
In this next clip, you're going to see an investigation, I believe, done by the Attorney General's office, where they're actually going in, watching. What you're going to see is two people actually just copying signatures down from one petition to the next.
Madam Chair.
While we're watching this, I don't doubt for one moment that there is some really unethical behavior among some of these paid signature gatherers. But this goes back to the question that you raised on the last bill about informed voters. I mean, your signature is a precious thing, and to just have somebody stop you someplace and sign up. Now, granted, a fraud was visited on her, but just the level of her disengagement with understanding how the petition process works is somewhat stunning.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Johnson, Chair Brown, Senator Johnson. That is an issue, and we also, to wit on that, I think it's important that citizens who want to change the laws of Oregon through the citizens process, I don't think, asking them to write their full name and address on something, I think it's a sufficient time for them to spend on it. It also gives the petition gatherer a little more time to talk to them about what's actually before them, especially when they're having six or seven sheets. So again, this is the big issue. We don't see a good reason why people other than the signer should be signing on those precious lines, except for a major if you're not physically able to do so, and there's a nice amendment in there to make sure that that is the case.
Madam Chair.
Sarah Miles Anderson.
So when you have someone who is disabled, what's the process of getting, they want to sign the petition, so what?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, they can ask the signature gatherer for help in signing, and the signature gatherer can, they can fill out the form for them.
Madam Chair, John Lindback, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. The person has to be able to affix their signature somehow, but it's the other information that you could assist the person with the disability in putting on the petition.
No, I'm just thinking of the elderly, Madam Chair, and at least with my father, he can barely do it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Anderson. The amendments are specifically drafted so that people who need help can do it, but we want to avoid people just, you know, relentlessly copying name after name after name. You might have in your packet from the last hearing samples of initiatives where if you look at the name and address, it was all clearly written in the same hand. The signature at the bottom, without being a signature expert, looks pretty different. And that's the problem this is trying to get at. And again, it's also very frustrating in our office when the name and address is wrong from the signature. And through work, our folks can figure it out, but it's kind of like, well, what do you believe? Who did what here?
I had a staff member check the other day on some petitions we had in the office where they had used writers.
They'd use what? Sorry?
They'd used writers, so-called writers, where they'd had people sign the petitions and somebody came behind and filled in the rest of the information. We found numerous cases just on single petitions of names spelled wrong, addresses wrong, which would affect whether or not that signature is counted. And if the person, if the signer actually puts their address and prints their name, you know it's going to be correct.
Anything else? Okay. Any other questions for these two? Thanks. I Senator Johnson, I think, raises a really good point, and I just I don't know what we do about educating voters. That's a whole other discussion about how critical, particularly with the level of ID theft out there, how critical and important your signature and your personal information are. And obviously, it's very easily accessible, but I do think we got to have some level of voter education, and I don't know how we do that. So, all right. Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2082? All right. Senator Farrielli, I know, is looking has some amendments. We'll probably bring back this bill the latter part of next week so that folks have had an opportunity for discussion, review, potential amendments. So the sooner you can get amendments in, the better. Thank you. That we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2082. I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 891. I understand that the parties are still involved in negotiations, but I'd like to hear from Ed Sullivan and folks from the City of Portland. Come on up. And we'll get a couple of the folks from the City of Portland. Mr. Sullivan, welcome again. You didn't know you were going to be called into service so many times today.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure whether I should give my prepared remarks in the light of the possibility of a resolution of this thing.
Why don't you hang on then, and let's get an update from the parties. This is our last business today, so... Thank you. Welcome. Just opened a public hearing on Senate Bill 891. Would like some comments about where we're at and where we'd like to go. Maybe.
Maybe I can begin, Senator Brown, members of the committee. My name is Greg Winterode. I am a land use planner at 310 Southwest 4th in Portland. I'm also a 30-year housing advocate and an old friend of Bob Clay, who's sitting next to me to my right, who represents the city of Portland. Bob and I have spent the last 45 minutes in intense discussion. We share very similar goals. We don't fully agree on how to get there. But I think we have a tentative compromise that has not been fully heard by the planning director of the city of Portland, who's sitting to my left, or Mr. Sullivan, who is an ardent opponent of this legislation, of this bill. All right, so what Bob and I will try to do, with your permission, is to explain where we think we are on this bill. So I wrote down six areas where we either agreed or didn't agree on amendments. And the first area was whether to have a study and assessment of the cost impacts. The second was the affordable housing amendment that the city proposed that you have before you. The third is a sunset clause. The fourth is the scope, where to apply the exemptions from clear and objective standards. The fifth is the density, where it would be applied to. And the sixth was whether there would be a density bonus associated with this. And so here's where I think we're at. Bob will kick me under the table if I get this wrong.
Okay.
We essentially agreed to the study language that's in the city's amendment.
Okay.
With the notion that we refine the parameters of that study slightly.
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
That we clarify the parameters of the study, but we
okay.
These minor changes. The second, we agree that the affordable housing provision should stay in there. We both agree on that.
That it would be as the City of Portland Amendment has drafted?
Yes.
Okay.
The third issue would be a sunset clause. We wanted a short one. They wanted none. We have tentatively agreed to a six-year sunset with a four-year study. So we have good information well in advance of when the sunset would come into play.
So can you give me sort of the time parameters of what you were looking at in terms of a sunset?
There were 6 years from now, essentially, would be the sunset provision, and 4 years for the study.
Okay. So for the folks who want the sunset, could you talk to me about why you feel like the sunset is appropriate, given sort of my very basic understanding of the bill, why you think the sunset makes sense?
The reason that I believe that we think it's important, and Ed Sullivan's here as well, is that without a sunset, the study could simply be a study. It doesn't necessarily have to be reviewed. With a sunset, it means it puts the cities and counties' feet to the fire to make sure that what may well be the case, that discretionary standards don't necessarily increase housing costs. It makes sure that people are honestly thinking about that all the time, and so the cities and counties are less likely to use discretionary standards in the way that Ed Sullivan and I fear they might.
Okay. City, you want to respond?
Good afternoon, or good evening, I guess.
Sorry.
Bob Clay, supervising planner with the City of Portland and the Bureau of Planning. Thank you for your patience. Appreciate it very much. Yes, I think the list that Greg has outlined is the correct list of items that we discussed. And we are in agreement about the study and the assessment with some modification to the language to clarify the scope of that. The affordable housing amendment, which was A4, by the way, we agreed to that. The sunset, our concern with respect to the sunset is it takes jurisdictions and especially the city of Portland quite a long time to develop a work program. It takes a long time to develop the budget for the process, and to walk through that process probably means, frankly, between now and next July 1st when the new fiscal year begins. So we probably would not be in a position to present going forward with this until about July 1 of next fiscal year. So there's a little bit of gap there. So the sunset was an issue for us that was very difficult to overcome because it makes us feel like, well, do we even want to, you know, go to all the trouble of putting together new code language and new provisions while there's a sunset hanging over our head. Nevertheless, I mean, that's why we agree to the study and do an assessment and be responsive, come back. Local governments would have to be responding by June 30th of 2010. We'd have 6 months to prepare the study and report back to the legislature. We felt that was doing about everything possible to move right up to doing everything but commit to a sunset and having the hammer overhead. Nevertheless, you know, Greg wanted the Mr. Winterode wanted the sunset in the 4 year time frame by 2011. Is that correct?
Okay.
And we've agreed to extend that to, out six years.
All right. All right, and then I had three other issues. I got number five was density. I didn't know what number four was. I missed that.
The four is where to apply it, and I think Bob should explain this one because this was the hardest one for us to give up, but Bob has been very persuasive in his argument, so go, Bob.
thank you, Mr. Winterode.
You can call each other by your first name, since okay. Clearly you've
Thank
been
you
doing great. That for the last
Thank
20
you,
years.
What we tentatively agreed to was to limit this discretionary approval authority to those communities that have a light rail facility or have a federally approved light rail alignment with environmental documentation. So that's both communities that today have light rail facility and those, once they get federal approval for light rail, would have that. The okay. effect of that is that it means Gresham, Portland, Beaverton, and Hillsboro today have light rail, together with a small portion of Clackamas County at the Clackamas County Town Center. It would mean, with respect to the OR language, federally approved according to environmental documentation, would mean it would pick up the south alignment that goes to Milwaukee in the future. So it would be five cities and a small portion of one county would be applicable. So those
are Gresham, Beaverton, Portland, City of Milwaukee.
And Hillsboro.
Okay.
And the Clackamas Town Center. And any light rail station communities that pass out of Portland to get, I don't
okay.
have a map right in
front
of me.
I'm with you.
But there may be one or two.
Okay.
So we, with the concept being there, those are the communities that have the light rail facility or one immediately planned. Those are the communities that are likely to accept the lion's share of the growth in the Portland metropolitan area that you are about to hear about today in our testimony.
Okay.
And if I might add,
sure.
That also distinguishes the Portland region from the rest of the state. And a concern that we had was, how could you tell Pendleton or the Dalles that they have to have clear and objective standards for approving needed housing, but Portland area doesn't?
Okay.
And we believe that by distinguishing based on light rail, that's something that perhaps Pendleton won't be having in the near future. So that was part of the rationale
okay.
for that as well.
And I think Senator Nelson would agree with that
yeah.
rationale.
It's on my wagon.
It's on your wagon.
Yeah.
Okay. And so five and six, last 2 points.
Do you want to do five or do you want me to?
Five was the city had proposed 18 units of the acre as the density threshold for the applicability of discretionary standards. and Greg has proposed 24. We had two rationales. One was simply that's the lowest residential zone. There's an R2 zone with a minimum density that implements the 2040 design type areas. And we also heard from the Metro Transit-Oriented Development staff that they were fearful that an applicant might come in one or two units below a level, say proposed by Greg at 24, in order to avoid discretionary design review, to only have to go through standards or nothing at all. So that was the distinction. I think Greg's point is 24 is a demarcation point at which you go above kind of garden-style apartments, two-story walk-up exterior. Our point was that we have a zoning implementation mechanism adopted through and complied through Metro that 18 was important to us, and we got a lot of feedback from stakeholders that 18 would avoid applicants trying to specifically get around the requirement.
And if I might add, if you look at the rest of the cities, the Greshams, the Beavertons, and Hillsboroughs, they don't have the same 18-unit threshold. And our interest is more in making sure that you really have to have high density, places that might need an elevator, that might need structured parking to apply the design standards, and that clear and objective standards at below 24 units an acre.
All right. So now that we're actually getting down in the trees in terms of the nitty-gritty details here, one of the issues that I didn't understand about, I think, Greg and Ed, your objections to the bill, is the whole issue of sort of gentrification and sort of pushing out low-income folks out further, frankly, and on my side of the river east. What I saw the original bill is doing as sort of making higher density housing more attractive and more appealing. So that's, I didn't ever get the opposition in terms of the affordability piece. To me, this made higher density housing more attractive, more appealing for everyone, frankly. Could you kind of respond to that?
Respond to
Ed, somebody, Greg, somebody?
Yeah, I'll begin, and maybe Ed would like to fill in. It's the issue is, in my mind, is that as you require developers to go through the discretionary design review process, there's very little limits on the authority of local governments, design review commissions, a staff person, to apply conditions that can increase housing cost. There's a concern that those conditions would vary by jurisdiction if applied across the board in the metropolitan region. And therefore, those communities with lower housing cost to begin with would become dumping grounds for low-income housing. Nicer areas would get nicer, poorer areas would get poorer.
Okay.
That's my concern, at least.
Yeah, and mine is that when you add the level of discretion, you add the possibility that density becomes just a trading stock for what eventually comes to be a backroom deal between the developer and staff, or the developer and the neighbors, to increase the cost, to extend out the process. In my written testimony, and I will never get to that, I have five or six examples where density was one of the issues. It's not supposed to be an issue. It's not usually talked about. It's talked about in terms of six or seven proxy things. But all that happens is that you lengthen out the process, you raise the cost, and you get to say no where you shouldn't say no, where you have housing that's supposed to be allowed outright.
You're saying design review becomes essentially a proxy for, okay, got it. All right, but we've sort of taken that issue off the table, my understanding is, with the exception regarding affordable housing. Is that a fair statement?
It's not going to come up so much in affordable housing, because
okay.
Affordable housing on the public side, Senator, usually has been vetted. It's been through a public agency, and it's going to meet whatever design standards the staff has. Where it really becomes a problem is when a private developer comes in, infill, and the people around it love their open space and don't want those people there.
And
welcome to our world within the urban growth boundary.
But the problem is that we're supposed to have taken care of that by the clear and objective standards criteria.
All right, Bob, do you want to respond? And then we move on to item six.
Ed and I slightly disagree on this point, but we did try to address that, the density issue and pushing the density down. There is a provision in the bill that we said that discretionary approval standards could not be applied, could not reduce the proposed density, the project proposed density, nor could it reduce the density allowed in the base zone.
Okay.
So both of those were our fallback, and I know that Greg and Ed disagrees on that.
All right. Sarah Monis Anderson.
Clarify for me, I know Portland, or I forget who wanted what, 18 versus 24. What did you come up with?
We wanted 18.
You wanted, Portland wanted 18.
But I think we tentatively agreed on 24 in exchange for going to a much larger area. That
okay.
was the dynamic.
All right. Sarah Monis Anderson.
Yes, and do you know if the outer jurisdictions would agree to that number?
I think what she's asking is whether the city of Gresham is okay with that number.
I don't know, Senator.
Okay.
And we'll make sure that the city of Gresham...
Well, I'm just wondering that I can see higher density within the Portland area, and I just don't know enough about this in the Beaverton, Hillsborough, or Gresham area.
I think I can speak with authority, and if Bob disagrees, we do work in all these jurisdictions, and as you go along on the light rail lines, that's where you typically have the 30-plus units per acre.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why 24 is a typical break-off point for the garden apartment zone, and then the higher density zone is where you typically find it along the light rail or in town centers or in regional centers.
I'd love to see a little bit more flexibility with depending on what the developers wanted to have. And
so if I could also clarify, the law is written now, as it applies across the state, does allow any developer to choose the option of a discretionary review standard. And I've also, as part of this whole process, I started going through all the clear and objective codes in the region. I mean, and they vary widely, but I was surprised that Portland and actually Gresham too could do a lot more with clear and objective standards and be legal than they have done to stop the atrocity that was shown to you at Raven's Apartments. No one likes those. I hate them. Okay. So we're not advocating for that kind of apartment development, but with stronger clear and objective standards, that could clearly be stopped.
Okay.
Made better.
Okay. Last point, I think you guys had six, and I only have five at this point.
Yeah, I have five, too.
Yeah. The last point was one by Bob, so I'll let him explain that one.
Well, maybe, Greg, I think you need to explain it. Well, I'm not sure I fully understood it. I guess, as I understood it, and I know Ed understands it, is there was to be a requirement that that in exchange for discretionary approval standards, there would be a 5% allowance for a 5% increase in the density, a density bonus, if you will, in effect, so that whatever the base zone permitted or the project came in, it could have another 5% density. And we just felt we would get all kinds of pushback from our community saying, well, what do you mean it's going to be an automatic blanket increase in density above the base zone or whatever, above whatever the original application came in for. So that was one that we were very uncomfortable with, automatic, just kind of across the board for anybody that came in through a discretionary review. See, the way the statute works today, Portland has allowed discretionary design review for the central city, the regional center, and historic districts. So already you'd be saying with this provision, now you not only Portland, yes, you had that, but now you've got to allow another 5% increase in density in the central city where we already have enormous floor area ratios and height issues, and the same with historic districts. So that was very uncomfortable for us to have something across the board.
And in my mind, that was directly linked to the 24. If we went up to 24, that would push it over so that density bonus wouldn't be as needed.
All right. You all clearly we're not ready to move forward on this bill today because we don't have language to reflect the agreement. It sounds like there needs to be a little bit of more work. I will tell you that the reason why the bill is in the Senate Rules Committee is that there was an issue over the whole affordable housing issue, and that was a very legitimate issue. The disagreements are clearly beyond that, and so I just want to say to everybody, I think we're working on what could be a really good product. You do not have a lot of time here. I do not have a lot of time. And I think John Christensen would tell you I don't have a lot of patience right now. So I guess my encouragement, I'm going to check in with folks from the city of Portland. You know, Ed, Greg, I don't know who you want to be, sort of your contact there, but I'm going to be having my staff check in pretty regularly, and I don't know if you have time to sit down and kind of get this all wrapped up tonight so we can get it to Legislative Council tomorrow. But I fully expect this to be on a very fast track, and I don't know what your schedules are. Unfortunately, our committee will not meet until probably the middle of next week unless I can get something scheduled earlier. But obviously, I need to see that the cities of Gresham, Hillsboro, Beaverton, Portland, and Clackamas Town Center and Milwaukee are at least copacetic in the direction we're going as well. And I know City of Gresham here, City of Portland's here. I'm as good as it gets right now in terms of Milwaukee, but I just I want to make sure that we're not running, you know, making some new enemies as we work towards agreement here. So if you need some help from my staff, you can have it. I just want to get this put to bed as quickly as possible. So, but I appreciate everybody's time and energy. I think we're working on good things. Do you guys have any comments?
It's good.
Sarah Nelson's not going to say anything unless we don't get him his racetrack in Hermiston. So. All right. Thank you very much. Anything else that we need to hear of tonight? All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate your hard work and keep it up. I'm going to be ragging you guys for the next couple of days. So
we
with that and that warning, we're adjourned.
Very good, Chair.
You're welcome.